This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Continuing this year's Bardolatry, KLPAC's Shakespeare 400 brings to its stage, in this case Pentas 2, Shakespeare's Men, following its Shakespeare's Women in May. According to KLPAC, and based on just visual proof reported by those from BFM frequenting the lobbies and theatres in that central space, there are bums on seats. So yes. Bardolatry is alive and well in KL, it would appear. Two of the four men who will be in Shakespeare's Men are here, Charles Donnelly and Kingsley Jett. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Charles, you were here back in 2011 with Joe Hashem when you performed in Frank McGuinness's Someone Who'll Watch Over Me, which also starred Kingsley. And Kingsley, you came with Joe in 2012 when you two together with Gavin Yap were in the complete work of William Shakespeare Abridged. So that the both of you know each other before working on that show, since you're from kind of different sides of the globe?
No, until we actually got together for Someone to Watch Over Me. Never met Kingsley before, never met Gavin either.
There you go. And this is the third time now, and it looks as if you two have managed to squeeze Joe out of the interview. So what would he have been able to contribute here that the two of you can't fill in? I mean, are we, you know?
Absolutely nothing. Nothing. he's off doing, he's got meetings or something, so otherwise he would have been here.
Yeah, you know, very Joe. Busy man.
Okay, but we come now to Shakespeare's Men. How much of the process of putting it together were you involved in, or were the actors involved in?
Initially Joe got in touch with the idea of doing Shakespeare's Men and just asked us to provide him with as many monologues and scenes as we could. I mean, your all favourite stuff. So he said, you know, he wanted about six.
Yeah.
About six. I couldn't get it down to six. So I finished up sending in about 14. And then that was just monologues. And then there were scenes as well. And Kingsley did roughly the same. The other guys did the same. So there was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of things.
There was a whole submission process.
Yeah. And then it was a case of just going through and throwing them out.
And what determined the selection of the pieces from your end? I mean, when you say, okay, we're supposed to have six, but you couldn't narrow it down. No. What were your personal criteria? Did you have an idea of, you know, what it was you wanted out of it?
Not at that point, no. I mean, Joe just said, can you submit like half a dozen of your favourite monologues? And that was the starting point. But unfortunately, I couldn't get it down to six. Things like, you know, I think three from the Scottish play, one from Richard III. Yeah, it was just...
Yeah, it was hard to select your six favourite pieces. Obviously, you wanted to do something that would cover the range of Shakespeare's work, something that was tragic, something that was comic, something that was, that was a good reflection of all his variety of plays.
And did any of, or how many, I suppose, of your favourites kind of survive the culling process and have made it into the final piece?
Two of mine, I think.
I think about five or six of mine have ended up in
favouritism.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah. The show. But yeah, it was... It's ruthless. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of pieces we would have liked to have seen stay in the play, but we wanted to try and find a balance of stuff that was more popular and slightly better known, and then also put in some of the rarer plays as well to give the audience a sampling, a selection of what Shakespeare wrote.
And how is that sampling being presented? Because by its nature, a sampler can be kind of a difficult thing to make coherent. Is there a need for coherence at all?
Good question. Ow! Okay, Kingsley, take it away.
Of course. You want the audience to understand where the pieces are coming from, but obviously in a showcase like this, it is hard to... to give complete context to everything. So each of the pieces that have been chosen, I believe, like especially the scenes, are things that can stand pretty much on their own and tell a story within themselves. So hopefully an audience will take that away from it.
I mean, with the scenes and the monologues, it becomes more of a sketch show than an overall play. It's a tasting, a smorgasbord, if you like, of just scenes and bits and pieces. Yeah.
And what does it end up saying about Shakespeare's men as a whole? You know, so having with so many plays to choose from, with so many scenes, with so many men, in fact, so many male characters. Mm. What's being presented here about how Shakespeare wrote his men?
I think it's more a case of just breaking it down and making Shakespeare more accessible, and just. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're a pauper or a king. It's just comments on the human condition, just throughout time. I think that's
all of the themes and ideals that come across in the monologues and scenes are things that we're still being writing about today in contemporary plays. Shakespeare covered love, betrayal, revenge,
power.
Honor, trust, power, corruption, et cetera, et cetera.
And these are things that we're still continuing to see playing out everywhere.
Indeed.
How many ultimately of the works are being used? How many of Shakespeare's works will be presented?
We've got in 15 scenes.
There's 15 pieces, probably, but some of the pieces are like there's two pieces from A Midsummer Night's Dream. There's two pieces from Henry VI, Part III. So that's 12 to 13 plays all up that are being taken from.
And are those plays... So when you have two scenes from the same play, are they presented back-to-back or are they kind of split up a little bit?
No, they're split up.
In the case of The Midsummer Night's Dream one, they are back-to-back, but they're not really connected in terms of story.
Right. So we come back to the whole idea of it being a sampler.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And do you worry about the... I suppose there's nothing to worry about in terms of the better-known the better-known plays. You know, that most people would have at least a passing familiarity with it or heard it expressed. But when it comes to the more obscure selections... how then is that kind of accessibility being brought to the fore?
As Kingsley said, I mean the less well known ones tend to stand on their own. I mean it's either a monologue or a little scene, which is pretty much self explanatory as it goes through. So I mean there's not too much out there that's really horribly obscure.
One comment that was raised post-Shakespeare's Women was that because some of the excerpts used were less popular, folks did get lost. What is being done this time to help the audience grasp the context, know who the characters are, so they just know, okay, this is kind of taking place here. That guy's, you know, jealous of that guy. That guy's in love with this girl. Go.
Oh, okay.
In most instances, we do introduce each monologue or scene in the banter between the gentlemen at the club. The sort of the framework is that these four gentlemen meet at this club on a daily basis or regular basis, and they challenge each other with, oh, you can do that bit from this play, go. And oh, okay, I want you to do this scene from this play. And we introduce the pieces in that way, and then they joke about how well or not well they've performed the scene.
And
there's a lot of drinking going on as well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. There you go, because men in a club.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
I'm speaking today with Charles Donnelly and Kingsley Judd, two of the men of Shakespeare's Men, which is coming to KL PAX Shakespeare 400 celebration. Up next, we find out more about that framework and how it came about. You are listening today to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and in the studio with me today, two of Shakespeare's men, Charles Donnelly and Kingsley Judd, discussing their upcoming performance. So it takes place within a club with four men kind of trading barbs, telling stories and reciting Shakespeare. What prompted the framing? I mean, why a gentleman's club? Why the alcohol?
Well, why not? well, apart from the fact it was Joe Hashem. I think the way it came about was that Joe wanted to come up with an idea of making it relaxed and
fun.
Yeah. Because initially, when we got over, we had no idea what to expect. I mean, you know, we knew it was Shakespeare. So I turned up here and I actually brought my own tights with me.
So just in case.
I was ready for anything, yeah. And then suddenly, oh, it's going to be all suited and booted and oh, okay, fine. Yeah.
Does that in any way kind of reduce the stakes of the scenes or the dramatics of the scenes, because you know that these aren't characters who are actually going to pull swords on one another and kill one another, for instance, because, you know, it's sort of a, in a way, it's a performance within a performance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True. I think it would have been more jarring for an audience to take if we were trying to, you know, change in between scenes.
Really do a
time.
Saturday Night Live Shakespeare.
To run off and get changed into something for the next play. Whereas within this framework, I like to think that the pieces in themselves will be enough to draw the audience in and understand the stories in those ways.
How important is the chemistry between the four of you? Because, I mean, if you're supposed to be people who have been meeting up for, you know, for a good many years to do this, you know, how important is that chemistry and where does it come from?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's actually quite easy. I mean, Kingsley and I have known each other for a good while anyway. And Colin and Oliver are really easy to work with. I mean, they're great guys. So there was no problem. I mean, we sort of hit it off pretty early on. And, it's just, you know, just one of those things that just developed. I mean, we've been really lucky in that way. But, there's been, you know, no egos, nothing. It's just, just mates. Yeah.
And it contrasts well with some of the conflict that happens within the scenes themselves and in the stories themselves. Like Oliver's character is kind of pinned as a bit of the lover. His pieces have that and within them. Yeah. And,
typecast.
Well, I was curious about that. I did want to know, you know, how did the divvying up of the scenes and the characters happen? Because you would be playing, I guess, a bunch of different characters because it's not a traditional play. So you're not necessarily cast as Romeo and then you are cast as Richard III, for instance. So how did that dividing up go?
Well, basically, I mean, we all submitted what we, our favourite pieces. And then if you were lucky enough, you got to keep them. If not, then, but, it was a directorial decision.
Yeah, in our first readings, we all got an opportunity to read the various pieces and try out in various roles. And from that, the sort of choices became kind of obvious within that. Though there's some characters that well, there's one in character in particular I'm now playing, which I didn't think I would end up playing, but somehow I've landed that role.
Yes.
So, yeah, but it's great. That's part of the challenge. That's part of the fun. That's part of the love of it all, to do these roles that you never expected to do.
So there are four actors on stage, and there are musicians. What role do the musicians play within the performance?
A big one. I mean, the music itself is amazing. Just to sit there and listen to it, which is all, you know, almost a not a hindrance, because so sometimes it's, you know, you listen to the music and you're just sort of drifting off. And you think, oh, it's me. I've got to do this. But I mean, the musicians are they're fantastic.
And the music is of the period. A lot of the pieces that have been selected from composers that were around during the Elizabethan era. Anthony Holborn was a composer from that time. I think it's John Dowland is another one. He was a lutist of the period from the mid-1500s to early 1600s. Henry Purcell, John Daniel, and also the music director, Ewan Eng, he's playing the viola da gamba, which is an instrument that would have been used in the time of the Elizabethan court. Like, it's something that Elizabeth I herself would have heard played. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, really, it is. I mean, it's I don't want to give too much away, because you really want people to come along and just sit there and just listen to this music. It is amazing. It really is.
Yeah, and the ensemble also contains a flute, which contrasts beautifully with the strings. It sounds lovely. In fact, you've got the name of
I've got the name, yes. Chai. Chai's the flautist.
Flautist.
Yes, flautist. And, I mean, I've heard the flute played before, and I it was an instrument I never liked. It was also like what was... sounded tinny and screechy, and I don't know how she does it, but she makes that flute speak. It's it really is. I mean, and the guys are all, I mean, all the guys, I mean, the musicians, every one of them is something special. Yeah.
And how is the music being used? Is it being used as a sort of backdrop for what you're doing? Is it used as bookends between scenes? I mean, you know, how is it being utilized?
It's a bit of both.
Yeah, occasionally it is used in some of the pieces that have been chosen. There is references to the music, like particularly there's a monologue that Charles is doing from Richard II where music is actually written into the piece. And Ewan has cleverly gone back and actually found the sort of music they would have been playing of that time. So that's integral to that piece. And also Troilus and Cressida, the scene that Colin and Oliver will be performing, is that has music in it as well. And sometimes the music is just kind of like a palate cleanser between the next monologue and the next scene. That's a real chance for the musicians to showcase their abilities and the music of that period and era.
And will we be able to see them? You know, in Shakespeare's Women, they were kind of tucked up away in the rafters. They were more
heard. About that.
Yes. Yeah. Are we going to be seeing the flute being played? And
You'll see them. You'll see them. They're going to be there.
That implies that there's something more that you're not seeing.
Well, it's the way the set's been designed. The musicians will be sitting behind like picture frames, so they're going to look like founder members of the club, but it may get kind of a Hogwarts thing where the pictures come to life.
In the walls of the club there will be these picture frames, and each musician will be
seated
within the frame. Yes.
I was also wanting to know, I mean, as actors and as actors who know and love Shakespeare well enough to be able to say, I have my favourite monologues, I have these favourite pieces. How were you introduced to Shakespeare? Because the idea of accessibility is an important one.
With me, the first time, I was still at school. And it was, it was one of those English lessons. And, okay, we're going to do Shakespeare. Oh, grief, no, it's terrible. And it was it didn't exactly put me off, but it was one of those things I thought, well, right, well, I'll never do that again. And then at drama school, started getting into it and got comedy parts, like Twelfth Night, like Merchant of Venice. It really started to open up things. And then you go on and you start to see, well, right, yeah, there's more to this thing than that. And suddenly it's not that big, I don't know, Shakespeare, that's a bit, I don't like that now. And it breaks that all down. You just realise that all he's done is write really, really clever stories. And that's it. It's just languages gets in the way.
For myself, I was at college and I was studying English literature. And the class were taken, I was a mature age student, and we were taken to a festival of Perth, Perth Festival show. And it was a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, and it was the first time I'd seen any Shakespeare, and I hadn't really read much at that time, and I was in my early 20s. And I saw this production, and I was blown away. And that's the thing with Shakespeare. It's meant to be experienced on the stage. And then after seeing that show, I got interested in acting and went on to university and studied Shakespeare and performed in Shakespeare at university.
Charles, I did want to ask, it's one thing to encounter Shakespeare academically and learn to, love him in that way. But where do you remember kind of the first performance of Shakespeare that you saw where you thought, man, I could watch, I could watch these plays all the time?
I can't actually know. No, I think the first play I didn't watch. I was in it. It was Twelfth Night, and I was playing Malvolio, and it was just you're watching the other actors on stage, and it's suddenly just think, this is really, really amazing. So I mean, I didn't actually go along to see a Shakespeare show until I was actually in one, and then after that,
But I can pinpoint it was 1990 was the year I saw that Midsummer Night's Dream, so that was my first experience of Shakespeare.
And are you both hoping that this will serve in some ways as an introduction of sorts to people who just have no familiarity with Shakespeare or with the plays?
Yeah, hopefully. Well, hopefully it'll make it a lot more accessible and people won't have that sort of horrible stigma. Think, I don't understand Shakespeare, then therefore it must be highbrow and I don't understand it, and it's not. No, it's just, like when Shakespeare was, he was a jobbing actor and he wrote plays to make money. And that's it. People would come along at the Globe during the lunch hour. And if they didn't like the show, they'd throw fruit, and they sat on the stage, beside the actors, and they're having conversations. It was just like TV, kind of.
For me, I hope ideally the audience will see, they might see one monologue that goes, "Wow, that one really piqued my interest. I want to go out and find more about that play." That story of that character. Hopefully, even if an audience might not connect with every single piece, there might be one that they go, yeah, that says something to me, and they will go away and try and learn more about that play, and that might lead to more of a love of Shakespeare beyond.
Shakespeare's Men will also have on its cast, besides our guest, Charles Donnelly from the UK and Kingsley Judd from Australia, two performers who are resident here, Colin Curtin and Oliver Johanan. The run starts on Thursday, September 1st. It will continue till Sunday, September 4th. The curtain goes up on this 1 hour and 25-minute show at 8:30 p.m. Thursday to Saturday, but 3 p.m. on Sunday. Tickets are priced at 45 ringgit, concessions at 35. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming in.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, and Joe Hashem.
I've been speaking today with Charles Donnelly and Kingsley Judd about Shakespeare's Men. You've been listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.